Welcome to the Invest Like a Boss podcast.
I'm Sam Marks.
And I'm Johnny FD. We're self-made entrepreneurs who invest our own money and use modern technology to invest like a boss.
Join us each week for exclusive interviews with our network of modern investors, business owners, and multimillionaires to discover new ways to invest our hard-earned cash.
Hey, bosses, this is Johnny, and welcome to episode 215 of the Invest Like Boss podcast. Sam, I went back to San Francisco. Do you know that?
I knew you went back to San Francisco. I want to hear about that. But I'll tell you what I really want to hear about is the situation on the border in Kiev as well. Give us a rundown on both.
Yeah, it's so funny that so many people messaged me saying, like, "Oh, Johnny, thank God you escaped Ukraine and ran, you know, and hid in San Francisco." And I was like, "What are you guys talking about?" Like, I bought a round trip ticket just to go back and see my family and pick up a few packages. I went back to San Francisco mainly. I mean, you want to know what triggered it? What sparked it? Mm-hmm. I wanted to buy the new Oculus Quest 2.
Oculus Quest, the VR headset.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The VR headset. And it's $550 here locally because all the import taxes and crazy things. Mm-hmm. And it's $300 in the US. So I was like, you know what? This would be a good time to go home. So I literally went back for a week, say hi to my family, pick up the Oculus and a few other packages, and I came straight back.
So you almost arbitrage your flight, but I'm sure the flights are not cheap right now.
It was cheap because now maybe like there's some panic flying, right? But at that time, nobody was flying because mostly because of a Romicon.
Oh.
And there was a round trip ticket for $850. And guess who paid for it? It was a previous guest of this show.
Frank Song.
Yeah. He said to me, "Johnny, like, I need somebody to go back and pick up my laptop." his employee was supposed to fly out in December, but they got really swamped and he couldn't do it. And he's like, "Johnny, like, do you know anyone who's like willing to just go like pick up a laptop and like a few hard drives and like and come back?" He's like, "I'll pay for the ticket, like it'll be like, you know, a huge favor." And I was like, mm-hmm. You know what? I was like, I actually kind of want to go and pick up a VR headset. And he said, "Dude, you'd be doing me a favor if you went back and picked it up." And I was like, "All right, I'll do it."
So you checked a few boxes. You did Frank a favor. You got a free ticket. You got to see your family and you picked up a new Oculus headset.
Yeah, it was a great trip.
Have you played with the Oculus headset yet?
It is so good.
Oh no.
It is so good.
Oh no.
It is so, 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 so good.
Oh no, 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 no. Has it changed the way you thought about like metaverse or anything that we've been talking about recently?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. On one hand, yes, because at this price point, especially for $300, it's no brainer. Like, I don't understand why everyone in the US doesn't buy one. I mean, you know, you guys spend $300 on way stupider things. This is an all-in-one unit. You don't need to plug it to a computer. It works, you know, just fine. Like it just works great, right? It's a good workout for games like Thrill of the Fight. It's a boxing game that's super realistic. There's, you know, some
that boxing game. I mean, I haven't played the new one, but I played the old one, and that was like the light bulb moment for me, where I'm like, "Well, man, this, like, when I'm in there and I'm having an adrenaline rush because I feel like I'm physically about to get into a fight, and like if the experience is that engaging already, then that application across different sectors of workplace and workplace collaboration and sporting and etc. I can think of a few other ones, but."
Yeah, there's definitely some other apps that have really been amazing as well. We can get to that, you know, the quarterly updates after I've been using it for a few months. Mm-hmm. But the downside, though, is I also realize how early it is, where you don't look realistic in, you know, these VR, like even the VR games, they're still very cartoonish. Uh-huh. They're very far from being an immersive experience where, you know, you actually feel like that is a world I want to be in. And then secondly, the apps, even though they're pretty good, I can tell that they're still in its early stages. I would say this is the turning point where it's gotten good enough where people are going to adopt it. I think it's, this is the point. The price has gotten low enough. The quality has gotten good enough, and there's enough games where, you know, and things to do with it where people will start getting it, and it'll turn, like it'll start, but it's, we're nowhere near kind of peak, metaverse yet.
We're talking about this when we did the three series on the metaverse, and I was talking about my experience with Oculus, and I'm like, I just don't see how everyone hasn't adopted this yet. And that it was this paradox, right? And I think you had mentioned, you know, do people really want to put on this clunky headset and things like this? And we're trying to figure out why people haven't adopted it yet. And Elon Musk was saying a very similar thing, like the metaverse is overhyped because no one wants to put on a headset for more than an hour a day type of thing. And I'm guessing that is true. And like some of the other smart people I've heard talking about, it's like, all right, you're going to put a headset on, basically A, play a game for an hour, or to B, like solve a problem. Like you might put on a headset to collaborate in a workspace meeting for an hour, but like, that's it. And we love these cell phones because we still very much control our environment. Like my screen time on my phone right now is like 6 hours a day. It's like crazy. I can't even control it anymore. I'm not even trying to, but it's nice to be able to flick my eyes down at the phone and flick my eyes up back into the real world. And I'm thinking that might actually be a lot stickier than putting on a headset, unless they can make the headsets like really basically like a more or less a pair of big sunglasses.
Yeah. I mean, we're so far from that. I would give that 10 years plus, you know, you're absolutely right. I love putting on my VR headset for an hour a day, but that's it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was even a video where someone tried to spend 24 hours in their VR headset, and it's like, you can't do it. Like your eyes hurt. It's like, it's sweaty. It's uncomfortable. The battery life is only like 2 hours, which is actually honestly fine because you don't want to ever use it for more than 2 hours anyways.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to be in VR for that long. It will change. You know, I think, you know, I can see the future changing, but right now people have overhyped how quickly VR is going to be adopted. They started hyping it, I remember, like 7 years ago when the first headsets came in, mm-hmm. and then nothing really happened for 5 years. Mm-hmm. I think this time it will adopt, but this is kind of like the PS, you know, two or the PS, you know, yeah, maybe it's like the PS2 where like it's getting pretty good. So I think a lot of people will buy it, but it's, you know, definitely not going to be completely, it's not going to replace anything.
Yeah.
Let's just say that.
Who knows? Metaverse immersion may very well be more via television screens, computer screens, and cell phones than VR headsets. But I think that's sort of the point, is you'll be able to access it in different environments from different devices.
Yeah. And, you know, as a segue to this week's guest and topic, a lot of people have been asking me, should they start investing in virtual land in the metaverse? And I'm like, it's such a gamble. It's like, you know, yeah, I'm sure some people will, you know, hit it big on it, but 99.9% of those are, you know, virtual land or real estate plays are going to just fizzle to nothing.
Yeah. You're betting on these platforms and companies that are creating these environments to be around in 20 years. And the thing is most of the companies that are doing it are like startups. You know, it's like, it's like, for lack of a better example, it's like Axis Infinity, who's got this game that's got a coin that's worth $5 billion, but they're like a 6-person startup in Vietnam with like, that's raised like $2 million. So it's like,
yep,
you know, good luck on betting on them to be around in 20 years. They might, but I mean, there's just so much competition and so many factors that go into keeping a company around for that long. So anyone that's buying land and like Decentraland or Sandbox or any of these other ones, they're effectively startups, and people are spending mm-hmm. millions of dollars to acquire land in them. They don't realize that like, there's no guarantee that land is even going to be around in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, absolutely. So super, super high risk, but also potentially super high reward versus physical real estate, something you can actually touch, something you can, you know, people actually can live in, mm-hmm. you know, that has real world utility. There's real world scarcity. You know, there's only so much land in US cities or, you know, around the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're actually being used for something. I mean, and it's crazy that even during you know, these times where the stocks are, you know, plummeting, real estate hasn't really changed, you know, and even in Ukraine, like you, like we're, you know, according to at least the US news, we're on the brink of war. Real estate prices haven't dropped, because if it did, I actually would consider buying something, but it's been pretty stable.
So I definitely want to hear more about what's happening in Kiev and your experience. Are you back there yet, but, or are you still in San Francisco?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that in the outro, because I'm sure there's some interesting stuff there. As a segue in this episode, as Johnny was just talking about commercial real estate, so we're going to have back on Tim Wallen. He's the CEO of MLG Capital. He's been there with them for, I think, 33 years. And for any of the new listeners, we had MLG and Tim back on the show in 2019. It was episode 121. We were talking about private real estate investing. But there's some new dynamics at play now. There's inflation is rising. I think the last metric that I saw that was published is like 7 or 8%. And Johnny and I talked about the kind of phony baloney of the consumer price index a couple episodes back. So who knows where that number really is. But also we're in an environment now where interest rates are almost guaranteed to be ticking up. I think yesterday the Fed nodded that they're almost definitely going to be raising rates, maybe as many as 4 times in the next year. So rising inflation, rising interest rates is sort of a market cycle, or I guess economic variables that we haven't been investing through. So we wanted to have Tim back on, basically go back to school for an episode and understand how interest rates and inflation affect commercial real estate and specifically multifamily.
There's just a ton of questions that we want to ask MLG about. So we're very happy to have them back on the show.
Tim, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here, Sam.
It is. It's good to have you guys back on. There's so much to talk about. So much in the world has changed. And it's great to have you back on for the second time. And we covered a lot of ground in the first episode with you, but a lot of new listeners since then. So I just want to make sure anyone who's new to the show has a quick introduction to yourself and how you originally got involved with MLG. If you could start us out with that.
Sure. Well, I've been with MLG for 34 years now. I came here, actually 33 years now, but I'm an old Price Waterhouse guy. I was in the San Francisco office of Price. I'm a goofy CPA tax kind of guy, but been living and breathing the real estate business for over 30 years. And when I came back from California to Wisconsin to raise my family, it was Price Waterhouse in Milwaukee, and got MLG as my client back in actually 1988. And then became the CFO and joined in 1989 and took over the leadership role as a CEO in the year 2000. So I've been in the leadership role here for roughly 21 years and been buying and selling real estate and trying to take good care of our clients for a long period of time.
You've been with a company for 34 years. You don't have a wrinkle on your face. It must be a very stressless job that you got there, organization as well.
I got a lot of talented people on my team for sure. And we got 650 people in the organization. And I got 9 CPAs like me and 5 attorneys, accountants, land planners, engineers. We have a very talented bunch of folks here. So it's a true blessing to work here and be around the team that we have.
Yeah. Tim, what do you think makes MLG unique or special? And I've had a great experience with you guys since I've been invested, but there's lots of commercial real estate funds and companies out there. I'm sure it's a very competitive market. How do you try to make MLG unique in what you guys do and offer?
You know, there's a couple of things that differentiates us as a firm. You know, the one thing is we're vertically integrated operators. So we manage roughly 28,000 apartment units. And so we're fixing toilets, we're shoveling snow, we're cutting grass, we're dealing with COVID issues, we're dealing with all the dirty, hard part of the business. And that's really the tough part of the business. But yet at the same time, we're the sophisticated investment banking type firm with a lot of technical, you know, financial and legal talent. And be able to do various, you know, complex, you know, technical, sophisticated type of financial structures. So, you know, bringing those together into one shop, you know, is unique. The other thing is the way we approach how we buy real estate. You know, we certainly, you know, find a lot of opportunities on our own, but about half of what we do is we actually proactively invest with other real estate operators around the country. So, for example, there might be 60 different real estate firms in Minneapolis that your listeners will want to invest with. We call on those guys. And we're calling on over 1,800 different relationships around the around the country, and we see 70 to 80 deals a month, and we're looking to invest in one or two of those. So it's a critical selection process. And plus we have the team that has the expertise to look at these deals. You know, you'd be shocked at some of the assumptions that come across our tables and what people assume in these projections. And it's our job to look at those and make sure that the assumptions that are on the table are, you know, really believable and achievable. So half what we do is find deals on our own, and half is that the JV equity strategy where we proactively invest with other sponsors around the country. And we do that in one fund structure. So you get that blend as an investor of that mix of asset classes and geographies and great opportunities around the country.
There's a lot under the hood, it seems like. I was just looking up the last time you were on the podcast, 2019. Good timing.
Wow.
So yeah. We've got a couple of critical years of changes in the world, life and business under our belt since then. But if you can give us an update, when you were on back in 2019, I think you guys were just completing, or actually, I think you're just fundraising or in the middle of fundraising for Fund 4. But if you can give us an update of where you guys are at with maybe that fund and what you've been doing since then, and then we can
get
into some other topics that I'm very interested in digging into.
Yeah. So Fund 4 was a $250 million fund. We closed out the last capital raise of that at the end of 2000. So Fund 4 was about a third of the capital was deployed in the middle of COVID. Mm-hmm. And that portfolio, you know, all in equity, roughly $250 million. You know, today, you know, we get audits that are fair market value audits, and it's probably worth $350 million today in roughly, you know, 2 years time.
Good news.
Just kind of nuts. Nice. Now our run rate pay rate is about 6.5% on a pay rate perspective, as far as cash flow that we're sending out to investors. So we're very pleased where we're at in Fund 4. Fund 5's, you know, been a great start. We opened up Fund 5, the $300 million fund with the right to go to 350. And we opened up in January 2021, so a year ago. We are at this point already $270 million of that $350 million is either deployed or about to be deployed in the next 90 days. Mm-hmm. So we're about 80% invested. So we're down to the last 20% of capital raise and equity deployment. So off to a great start. We got a nice mix of assets that we put together. So heavy multifamily. Historically, we've had a larger mix of commercial assets. Mm-hmm. You know, Fund 5 is trending towards, you know, really 95% multifamily. You know, historically, we've made more like 85% in our funds multifamily, and then a blend of office, retail, industrial. You know, Fund 4 had zero office or retail. You could say that we're lucky or smart, whatever you want to say, but that we couldn't find something. Pre-COVID, we couldn't find retail or office to buy because the valuations had gotten too high in our view relative to the cash flows that office and retail produce. So we're heavy multifamily. We're biased towards multifamily and industrial anyways. About 5% of Fund 5 is industrial. We love industrial, but it's really hard to get right now. It's a very competitive. Everything's really competitive right now on the buy side overall.
So how many assets does Fund 4 and Fund 5 have?
So Fund 4 is roughly 30 assets. You know, Fund 5 is sitting at roughly 23, 24 assets today. Mm-hmm. And you know, working our way up. You know, it's a nice basket of stuff. We're seeing incredible rent growth that we've seen, and won't get ahead of myself here, but it's really interesting environment right now that we're living through with all the liquidity out there in the marketplace and all the capital, and now we're possibly talking about higher interest rates, and it's a very interesting time.
If one of the funds liquidates one of the assets, What would actually happen in that scenario? Would you guys, does that ever even happen before a more collective liquidation? And if so, do you guys return or distribute those funds, or do you keep the cash on the balance sheet, or what would
that? Well, we kind of make that on a case by case basis. So for example, I'll go back to like Fund 2, Fund 3. We're selling an asset in Fund 2, Fund 3, which is 2014, 2016 vintage. We're going to send that money out and distribute it out. Mm-hmm. Fund 4, you know, we do have the right of reinvestment in the first 5 years of every one of our funds. So we have the right to reinvest. It really depends on the fact and circumstances at that moment. Is there something else to put the money into that makes sense? Mm-hmm. You know, at that point, you know, fund four will be, you know, roughly 3 years in. We tell people they're going to get all the money back within 6 to 8 years plus 8% rate of return. There'll be other assets to sell beyond that 6 to 8 year period of time, and roughly taking 10 years all in approximately in a fund. So right now, fund four, we have to, if we bought an asset next year that we're selling, it has to be an asset that we expect to sell within a 5 to 7 year period of time. Mm-hmm. It can't be an asset that we're going to hold 8 to 10 years. It has to be an asset that would be a 5 to 7 year hold or less for us to consider putting that money to work. So at that moment in time, we got cash. You know, do we have a deal that fits that parameter or not? And if not, we'll send the money out. If we have a deal to put it in, we probably would reinvest it.
Take us back to when COVID broke out. And no one really knew what this thing was going to be or what the government's position was going to be. Like, what happens at MLG Capital once you realize this virus is going to inevitably get to the USA? Like, what, sure. Do you guys have kind of a war room planning, or like, I'm just curious. Sure. Things seem to have worked out well, but I'm curious as what the attitude and mentality was like when it actually first happened.
First of all, you know, my belief is that you need to buy through cycles. Mm-hmm. And we bought through the whole, you know, COVID cycle, and everything we bought in the middle of COVID cycle is a monster home run. And so, you know, having the, you know, people who bought stocks in April of 2020, a monster home run. So having the discipline to buy it but the key is, are you being real about your assumptions, right? So if we bought something in the middle of COVID, we have to be real about what kind of collections we're going to get on rents. And if you look at our existing portfolio, you know, I'd say on average, we had, well, if you took about the class, we've got the more worker housing, class B, class C product, you know, we might have had 10% of our tenants not paying their rents. Mm-hmm. Class A stuff, we were collecting all of our rents. So depending on the mix, and we maybe had 6 to 7 to 8% of our rents that we weren't collecting. But even through that, like Fund 4, it still paid a 4.5% pay rate all through COVID. Part of that gets back to the fact that we do lower leverage than most real estate guys. You know, our philosophy is not to use max leverage. We don't look at using 65% leverage. And you know, if we were using a debt fund and going to 75 to 80% leverage, you know, and also you're not collecting 10% of the rents, it starts getting a little scarier, right? Yeah. So, you know, we did our mathematics, the war room conversation that you referenced, and we went through every asset. We did the mathematics on how much could collections drop where we wouldn't be able to pay off our bills. And we could have dropped 25 to 30% in gross revenue and still paid all of our bills. And it gets back to having the lower leverage point. And I've been doing this business for 30 plus years, as I mentioned. And you know, what gets people in trouble is over leverage. And I don't believe the extra return you get by the higher leverage is worth it. And it's certainly a temptation to do that. No different than margining stocks. You know, margining stocks all fun until the market mm-hmm. goes against you. And then you feel the pain of a margin call. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I've been doing this long enough and I've seen what happens. Lower leverage is very important for long-term investing in real estate.
Did you guys ever see asset prices actually drop because it from the pre-COVID levels? Because I remember when COVID broke out, I'm like, sweet, finally going to get that lake house on Lake Norman, like at half price. And we just never saw prices dip at all. Yeah. It was like stable and shaky, but there was never really a drop that I saw.
Yeah, well, that's a good description. What we saw was be able to buy stuff maybe a 3 to 5% discount. In fact, we had two deals that were under contract that we went back and got a discount in that range because we were under contract the things going nuts. Mm-hmm. And so we were fortunate to be in the due diligence period, but we were able to get that discount of 3 to 5%. But that's all we could get. We tried for more. That's all we could get, you know, mm-hmm. And then the other deals that came on market were also in that kind of 3 to 5% discount, but it quickly corrected. It was quickly right back to old pricing. And then, you know, you go through and the rent growth that we've had in the last, you know, 18 months is substantial. And you know, value growth has been substantial because of it.
Okay. So that's what I want to jump into now. It's time to go back to school. If you can take me there, Tim, because since I've been investing, I've never, let's just say the last 10 years, there really hasn't been an environment like this where you have really rapidly growing inflation. And now we're talking about an interest rate hike. And these type of dynamics I'm very interested in, but I'm interested in how they affect specifically commercial real estate or multifamily. I think that the Fed hinted today that they're talking about raising interest rates. But can you take us through a little bit of the dynamics there, of why interest rates would be going up and how they affect the assets that you guys are in?
Sure. Big picture, when rates are going up, you always have to ask why. Mm-hmm. And the why is because we're having strong economics and inflation's kicking in, and real estate's extremely well positioned to handle that. Mm-hmm. Because if you got strong economics, you're going to have better rent collections, you're going to have better occupancies, you're going to be able to move rents. And there's lots of things that offset it. There was a study that we could share with you some other time, but Standard & Poor's did a study, a 30-year study of inflationary cycles and asset classes. Real estate beat every asset class, hands down, in inflationary cycles, and which also involves higher interest rates. It even beat out gold. And the stock typically underperforms other asset classes. Bonds get crushed. And holding cash is horrible in inflationary cycles because your cash is worth less as inflation goes up. So, but real estate was, by the Standard & Poor's opinion, the best asset class to be in. And I, in fact, I'm a believer of that myself and understanding what happens in this cycle. But real estate's uniquely positioned for the exact point we are in the cycle. And even though real estate's had its run, there's reasons why it is a fantastic asset class to own right now. Stock market down 10-15% in the last couple of weeks here. Real estate is not down. If anything, it's up, And the key of private real estate, it's got a very low correlation rate to the public market rates. It's like only a 0.3 correlation rate. So it's a great diversification tool away from the public markets. It's also a much better hedge than, say, like public REITs. Public REITs have a high correlation rate to the S&P 500. And you'd think that public REITs would have the same kind of thing. Now, underneath, inside the REIT, yeah, good things are happening. But truth of the way the stock market treats it, they crush them like all other, income, fixed income type stuff as rates go up. And private real estate's in a unique position where we are in the cycle.
I had heard someone say, I think it was like a hedge fund trader say one time, if you're worried about inflation, own your house. And if you have extra money, own stocks. Sounds like you more or less agree, but you'd probably say own your house. Just advice for the average person, own your house. And if you have extra, invest in multifamily.
Yeah, big picture is true. I think the only caveat to that is you have to understand private real estate is illiquid. Mm-hmm. So, or the public stock, if you need that money tomorrow, you can sell the stock and get cash. Private real estate, you can't. So you have to be smart about how much you put into private real estate, because you got to understand it's an illiquid asset class. And so you put your money to work. You got to be willing to let it sit there 6 to 8 years, and you can't go take it out to go buy that second, go to buy your first house or second home or go on a trip or whatever you want to do with your money. It's illiquid, but it's well positioned, and I think better positioned than stocks are, in my opinion, to handle the cycle that we're in right now.
Okay, so I kind of understand more about interest rate rises and asset prices. How would they specifically affect cash flows or rents per se of some of the multifamily assets you're in?
So when you look at this impact, look at the impact of interest rates on assets and interest rates going up, it's a couple things. Again, you have to go back to why are rates going up? Well, rents grow up because you have inflation, a strong economy. Cash flows are going to grow because you got strong economy, strong operations. And I'll break it up. I'll bust it apart a little bit. The other thing is you have to say, what is the impact on property valuations? Because in theory, with higher interest rates, you might also expect higher cap rates, which means lower valuation on that multiple of earnings. But I think what we'll talk about here as we go, real estate can handle it. Bottom line, my belief is that cash flows growth will more than offset any kind of negative impact by higher interest rates, hands down. And I can walk you through that as we walk you through.
So cash flow should improve primarily because rents, you're able to to tick up.
But it's growing rents, right? The nominal rent we charge, we go from $1,000 a month, we get 6% inflation, we charge $1,060. You also have increased occupancy, you got a strong economy, right? You go from 94% occupancy to 96% occupancy. You pick up 2% there, 6% on rents, and then all of a sudden, you don't have concessions anymore. You're not having to give up, you know, a month free for a 12-month lease, or your tenants are in well-paying jobs, and they're not going to have delinquencies. You're not going to have money not paid because your guys aren't working, and they don't have a job, and they lose their job. So there, you know, all different things. You can quickly see, you know, if delinquencies are maybe historically 1% or 0.5%, concessions 0.5%, 1%. You know, yeah, that's maybe 1%, 1 or 2% increase in cash flows. Pick up 2 points on occupancy, that's another 2%, 6% on rents. All of a sudden, you're up 10% in gross revenue, just like that. And that 10% more than offsets, you know, interest rate movement for most situations overall.
So that's okay. So that's the positive side.
Yep.
Generating more revenue. And then that has to offset what would be, I guess, your whatever debt instruments. And you had mentioned that you guys don't use that much leverage, but you'll have some type of debt. Can you explain how you guys manage that in a rising interest rate environment?
Yeah. So big picture, there's floating rate debt where your interest rates aren't fixed. So as the Fed fund rates go up, your interest rate costs go up. And then there's fixed rate debt where you buy an asset and you get, you know, 5, 7, 10 year fixed rate financing, and maybe your interest rate's fixed at 3.25% for 10 years. So let's talk floating rate first. If you got floating rate debt, our math shows we need about 5 to 7% revenue growth to offset a 1% move in interest rates. So what they're talking about right now is the Fed funds going up maybe 4 times this year, which would be 1%. So to make up for a 1% movement in short-term rates, you need your gross revenue to grow something like 5 to 7%, depending on the leverage and the quality of asset and many, many factors, if you're floating rate debt. However, if you're fixed rate debt, your interests are fixed. It doesn't go up. And so if your gross revenue goes up by 10%, like I just talked about in the quick example I gave, all that 10% falls to the bottom line. Now your operating expenses in theory will go up, expenses will go up some too, mm-hmm. but the gross revenue, there's more elasticity in that than the operating expenses. So as a guy with fixed rate debt, you're like, yeah, man, I'm glad these rents are going up and you're killing it.
Right.
If you're floating rate debt, you're a little nervous, is you getting enough revenue growth to offset your higher interest costs? So there's a big difference between floating rate debt and fixed rate debt in this cycle.
So wouldn't everybody want to get fixed rate debt, or is it, it's a, like if we're at almost zero interest rates, wouldn't everyone want to get fixed rate because it's really only a matter of rates increasing? If you had high rates, then you might want to do floating because there's a chance it could go down, right?
So I'll tell you about our industry. Our industry for the last, let's call it 10 years, a lot of our industry has been playing with fire and floating rate debt. And through this whole cycle, we stayed with a high blend of fixed versus floating rate debt. The time we use floating rate debt on acquisitions, because when we buy the asset, we believe we're going to sell that in a 3 to 5 year window. So if you believe you're going to sell it in a relatively short term, you don't necessarily want long-term fixed rate financing, because if you unwind that debt on a sale, there's large prepayment penalties. Now, if we do floating rate debt, we'll still buy an interest rate cap, or we'll swap it out to, you know, a short-term 2 or 3 year fixed rate type thing. So you use floating rate debt, in my opinion, wisely, if your hold period is shorter, because if you want to exit, right? And you still might do some hedging on interest rates by buying interest rate caps where you can buy a cap that rates won't, your rate on loan won't go above a certain level. Mm-hmm. Or you can swap it out where you swap out to a fixed rate. So right now, this exact moment in time is why we've always been conservative. Now, frankly, we'd have made a lot more money the last 8 years if we had done more floating rate debt, because the market paid everybody for the risk they took, and because the floating, the short-term rates stayed low much longer than historically coming out of recovery. But we're now is kind of where the rubber's meeting the road, and I think that game is now over, and I think we're going to see, you know, some increases in short-term rates. The difference in long-term rates might not move nearly as much. Even like in the last, you know, 6 months, 5 months here, like the 2 years up like 70 basis points, the 10 years up 30 basis points. So it is a little different. Like, we can still borrow money, 10-year fixed. We're about 160, 170 over the 10-year treasury. So we're still in a 3.4, 3.5%. Not bad interest rates, I mean, versus historic standards, yeah. Even though the 10-year has already moved up a chunk.
All right, general economy question. This actually I was thinking of yesterday. If interest, or let's say if inflation's at, say, 7%, 8%, and a bank is lending out money at, say, 3%, 4% fixed, aren't they just like getting killed? Or is it because they basically are borrowing money for free that like whatever they make is profit?
If you look at the statistics that are out there, the amount of deposits in the banking system right now is through the roof. Effectively, if you look at, I think it was like $5 trillion of stimulus money. A lot of that stuff landed right in the bank's deposit. Between companies and individuals, the amount of deposits is record levels, and it's like double of what it was pre-COVID. Monster cash out there. So they're not paying much in interest rates. So what you said is effectively correct. I sit on a bank board, that you're lending money that, you pay a deposit guy 50 basis points in interest rate or something, and you lend it out at 3.5 or something, or 3.25, and you make the spread. It's all about the spread. You make money on the spread. What does it cost you for that money? What do you lend it for?
Okay. Very interesting stuff. Very complex stuff. So let's say you can play king of the economy for a day. What would you like to do? What's best for MLG's portfolio? If interest rates tick up a little bit here, is that better? If inflation is better, like, is there a perfect scenario?
I don't think there's necessarily a better. I think you just have to, the key is discipline and underwriting. Mm-hmm. Am I making assumptions that are reasonable in the context of the environment that I'm in? Right. And that's what's critical to the real estate investing is are you making wise assumptions? And right now, it's most obvious that rates are going up than it's ever been in the last 10 years. There was all this conjecture before, but now they're doing it, right? Rates are going to start moving in March here. They're doing it. So from my perspective, we just keep plugging and chugging on. We look for opportunities and we look for things that make sense. And we just make assumptions that are real. I mean, you just got to be real about where rates are going. We look at the forward yield curve projections on what we assume if we're using floating rate debt because we want a short-term hold, or we're locking fixed rate. We don't, if we're going to hold an asset for, 6 to 7, 8 years, we're going to have fixed rate financing. Okay. That's just what we do. And there's no reason to take that risk.
Yeah.
And because when you get inflation, all that revenue goes to the bottom line if you got fixed rate financing.
Okay, so can we expand on that for a second? So we talked about interest rates, and I know we touched on inflation a little bit, but can we talk about inflation specifically with regards to your assets and how that impacts cash flows?
So if you look at MLG, if you look at our portfolio, we're about 60% fixed rate, 40% floating rate debt. Okay. And the 40% is floating because the assets are going to hold for a shorter period of time. Mm-hmm. So the blend of the two, MLG, I'll cut to the bottom line mathematics here.
Yeah, great.
We need about 2 point. If we see a 1% move in short-term rates, we need about 2.7% revenue growth to offset the cost of a 1 point move in short-term rates. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I will tell you, we're seeing real rent growth. I mean, if you look at our lease tradeouts, third quarter of last year, lease tradeouts, that's a tenant A renews and stays, or tenant B leaves the property and a new tenant C comes and takes B's spot. Mm. Our blended lease trade up between move outs and renewals was 6.3% in the third quarter last year. The fourth quarter, which is generally our softest quarter, December, people just disappear. They can move back to mom and dad, they move in with a buddy, they spend money on trips, presents. They tend to just disappear. And we always typically have softness in the December cycle. This last quarter, we saw 10% rent growth on lease tradeouts on average.
Wow.
In the fourth quarter. It's nothing I've ever seen before in my career. Now, I believe that we're going to see 3% growth at some point here to stabilize out to 3% growth. Mm-hmm. And what we're seeing right now is an aberration. Now, but if somebody gave me a performer right now and said, I'm going to assume 6% rent growth the next 2 years because we're an inflation cycle, I would not assume that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't accept that assumption. The deal needs to work on assuming 3% rent growth. And if we actually get 6% rent growth, that's gravy to the numbers. You know, I'm not going to assume some crazy high inflation number, even though we're seeing it. Now, if the leases already have the rent growth, I'll assume that. But from here forward, we're going to assume something reasonable like 3% on rent growth, not the 6 that we just experienced the last couple quarters.
So we've just had this massive run up in at least asset prices. Where do you guys see the opportunity for multifamily in the cycle that we're in? And how about for all the people that are on the sidelines that have not invested yet? They're thinking, did I miss the boat? Is it too late to invest in multifamily?
Yeah, it's never too late. And the beautiful thing, you know, I love people. I love being around people. I have 8 kids. I have a huge family, 1 wife, 8 kids, big family.
And still no wrinkles on the face. I don't get this.
Well, because they keep me running. They keep me running, Sam. But, you know, the bottom line is there's people, and people on occasion make mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. The human element of owning real estate is real. It's a very fractured, fragmented marketplace, and there is a whole range of really good operators and not so good operators. Mm-hmm. And there's rookies, and there's experienced pros, and there's people that gamble by, you know, floating rate debt, and the people that don't gamble. So if you look at that, I'll use an example: the deal we bought in Atlanta recently. A guy sold his business. He said, "I'm going to manage this asset all by myself. I can do it. I ran this business. This is not that difficult. I'm going to run this thing myself." Well, we bought the property from the guy for $139,000 per unit in a submarket that everything's trading for $180,000 per unit. His occupancy is only 85%. His rents are below market. His tenant mix was iffy. He didn't do a good job on qualifying people that actually have the ability to pay their rent. Really poor operator. And we bought that deal. Actually, got it off market on top of it. So here are two major errors as an owner. One, he didn't hire people that actually knew what they're doing to run his asset. Okay. Two, he sold it off market. He never should have sold that deal off market. Right now, if you take a multifamily asset to market, you're going to get 30 to 40 bids on that asset. Easy. Wow. In today's market right now. So it's really easy to maximize the sales price. But yeah, so we get this deal for $140 a unit. Yeah, is it a heavy lift to fix? Yeah, we got a lot of work to do on the property management side, but we manage 28,000 units. We know how to fix the problem, right? But so, you know, inexperienced folks, people who don't know what they're doing. There's also the folks that miss the opportunity. They like to manage to occupancy and say, you know what? I love being 99% occupied. I can go back home at night. I can sleep well. I'm 99% occupied. But the cost of being 99% occupied is that your rent's maybe 10 to 15% below market, and you're missing the opportunity to grow the value of your asset.
Got it.
And so in that situation, you buy the asset, typically the rents might be 10, 15% below market, and you create value. The way we create value in real estate is take the current income, and we have some strategy to grow that operating income through expense control, revenue growth, and the human element is forever there, you know? And that's why I believe you can buy real estate in all cycles, whatever environment you're looking at, just because of that one reason alone and overall. So anyways, that's how we look at it, and I'm very confident. I want to say one something else that's important to understand right now. If you look at rent growth, and it's been a lot the last 6-7 years, okay? It's been a lot. But it's very important to go back 20-21 years. Go back to 2001, to go to January 1st, 2000, okay? 21 years ago. And you look at rent growth, the compounded rent growth from that point in time to actually, this is math to see last summer, mm-hmm. only 2.6% compounded rent growth on a compounded basis long term. And the reason is, in the early 2000s, you had flat to no rent growth, or even declining rent growth in some locations, because of the no doc, low doc loans. When you could go buy a house, you know, no credit check. If you had a down payment, you could buy a house. If you want to buy 5 houses, you can buy 5 houses. You know, no problem. But it took people out of multifamily that really couldn't afford single family, but they were able to buy it. and ultimately led to the whole financial crisis and the Great Recession in 2008-9-10. But it really hurt multifamily. And you start getting a little recovery in 2006, 2007, and you got slammed again with the Great Recession. Hmm. So really from 2000 to 2012, we had very mundane rent growth for a long period of time. But if you look at construction cost growth, what does it cost to build multifamily? The same 20-year period of time, the compounded growth of cost is 3.5% per year compounded. So in my belief, rent growth on existing assets can grow something up to close to new cost construction, not really all the way there because there's always a lag factor. But I think 3% into the future indefinitely is very believable if you believe costs of construction are continuing to clip along,
right,
you know, and that kind of range. Plus, we still have this long-term history of rent growth that was behind reality caused by really poor government policy in the late 90s because it took people out of multifamily into single family. It was well-intended, but it wasn't well thought out.
Yeah.
The intent was to get people into homes, which is sweet, but the reality is not everybody could afford it and it caused all kinds of problems. So anyways, the rent growth that we had, I think, is sticky and permanent. Mm-hmm. And I think rent growth in the future is real. And I think human error is real. And there'll be opportunities because of it.
Got it. Tim, I wanted to clear up a question about Fund 5. Where are you guys focusing most of the geographical, or where's your geographical strategy for those assets?
Yeah, we're middle America folks. When I say middle America, it's Florida, up to Virginia's, up to, you know, maybe Pennsylvania, across to Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, out to Denver, out to Phoenix, and then back to through Texas and back to Florida again. We stay away from the coasts. Coasts are goofy in my mind on valuation. I do not understand the mathematics. Everything
you could,
I've ever...
You could have stopped that statement with just saying the coasts are goofy.
Yeah. Evaluation, I mean, most of the stuff trades at numbers, it's almost like zero cash flow. Mm. And it's like, I just don't know how people do that. And they're betting so much on just pure inflation and value property appreciation. Now, we want to see cash flow.
Yeah.
And we want to see cash flow that can grow.
Gosh, Miami. Some of my buddies that have houses in Miami, well, they've done very well in the last couple of years. It's like,
sure,
all of a sudden, Miami's like the most expensive real estate in the world. I don't know. One personal question too, Tim, just regarding Fund 4. So whenever that gets wound up, will we as an investor, for instance, will I as an investor have the ability to roll that over into a new fund and get the, I forget what the tax benefit's called, it's 10 something?
Well, 1031. The answer is no. You cannot, in private real estate, you have to trade title for title. So to get the 1031 rule. So if I own a piece of real estate, if I sell a piece of real estate, the entity that owned that real estate has got to trade into another piece of real estate. When you own an LLC interest or a non-traded REIT interest or something like that, you don't own direct title to the asset. You have an interest in an LLC or a partnership. And so you're not privileged to that. Now, we at the fund level can sell an asset and do a 1031, but you as an individual can't with your value growth. Now we have some idea. We have an evergreen fund, which we haven't talked about here today, but it's an evergreen long-term fund where we do that systematically and we take properties in. It's a different vehicle and it's meant to pay less tax and do a lot of trading under 1031 rules, but that's a different product than our closed-end funds.
Great stuff. Tim, I'm glad you're running this business. I learned a lot on this podcast. I'm
going to go back
and re-listen to it, probably have a glass of wine later and try to crunch all the numbers.
Maybe I'll have that glass of wine with you, Sam.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Well, I hope you get a bunch of ski days in. I know you're an avid skier. And also, I know you do a lot of work in charity, so appreciate that and the service that you do there. But for anyone who's interested in MLG, can you give us a little information of where to point listeners to?
I think the simplest thing is probably just looking at our website. It's MLGcapital.com. It's I always say Mary, Larry, Gary. It was a different, a moonless age long ago, but it's Mary, Larry, Gary, MLGcapital.com.
Okay. And are you guys actively raising for any funds?
Yeah, we have on Fund 5, of the $350 million, we have about $80 million left to allocate out to folks. Mm-hmm. That will go quickly here. It'll probably be gone, I would guess, by June. So we got a couple months yet. But the way the money's flowing in, and we also got a bit of a hockey stick at the tail end of the fund. Okay. At this point, we're 80% invested. We get a lot of visibility. And the end of the fund always goes very quickly.
And will there be a Fund 6 and a Fund 7?
Oh, sure. I mean, the reality is, like I told you before, we invest through all cycles. Mm-hmm. We'll launch Fund 6 later this year and, keep on doing what we do, trying to find great real estate opportunities where somebody's making a mistake that we can create value in.
I love it. Tim, it's been great to have you on the podcast second time around and learned a lot more here. But you guys are doing great, great work, and appreciate it from being an investor and also from being a student and learning a little bit more here on the show. Thanks for your time.
All right. Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it.
That hit home for me when he said that, because for the last 7 years, the REITs that I have in Singapore have just been going straight up, and they seemed somewhat uncorrelated to the stock market, but they've taken a nosedive in the last 3 or 4 months. They're down. They're all down like 20, at least 20%, 25%, I think. And that's like, it's not fun to see, right? Cause I invested in those over there to be sort of diversification and a hedge against a lot of my equities more in the US, but in at least in this specific market cycle, they're also taking a dive where all my commercial real estate, across my entire portfolio, all my commercial real estate has done very well in the last 5 to 8 years, including like Fundrise. But my residential real estate and my REITs have not necessarily. Like my residential real estate's mostly flat, I would say. Mm-hmm. Barcelona, haven't really owned it that long, but all my stuff in Thailand, like, is probably flat or even down, I would say. Where else do I own real estate? The USA.
Carolinas.
I haven't owned it that long, I guess. And then the REITs have always done good, but then, I mean, to Tim's point, like the REITs sold off along with tech, the tech sector, especially this time around. But all the commercial real estate, the different funds that I'm in with MLG, even Fundrise, I'm also in Apex, I'm in a deal with Omar, and then in the self-storage in Hong Kong, all those have done great. You at least don't notice the volatility. Even if there is a little volatility in there, you don't notice it. But I tend to think that there really hasn't been volatility to a large degree.
And Tim's explanation is really good. You know, it's hard for people to sell or offload physical real estate. I mean, first, the cycle of actually selling it is a lot longer. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, fees involved. There's, you know, especially if it's on the kind of a long-term fixed rate loan, it's hard for people to get out without big penalties. I think it's really smart that they, you know, like, and why anybody would even use a floating rate debt. You know, it makes sense. You know, I'm happy that MLG are an investment that people can get into, because it sounds like they're doing a lot of things right. You know, I like that they don't max leverage, you know, their money loans out there, because that's the biggest fear. You know, it, like, we would never, you know, 10x leverage a stock purchase or even an index fund purchase. Mm-hmm. But there's so many like real estate investors and funds out there that just max everything just to get big numbers. But it's a huge risk.
You know, I also want, there's one other point that I've never talked about this. It's not like a huge point, but it's just a comparison that I thought of recently in two different funds that I'm in, where like MLG, when I invested, whatever you commit to, let's just call it $150,000. As soon as like the docs are signed and you're good, like you put that money in and then you start earning the interest. You start earning your preferred basically right away. Whereas one of the other funds I'm in, it's set up as a capital call fund. So let's say you also invested that, you commit to that same 150, they might call that capital 12 times over the next 18 months. And so I didn't really understand the difference going into it, or maybe I understood the difference, but I didn't actually know what that experience would be like. But man, it's so much better just to like commit and get the money in and start earning than have to allocate like over the course of 10 times to a fund, because I'm having, you know, every like 6 weeks I'd be sending a wire or bank transfer for whatever, 12 grand or something. And I'm just like, it's just more things to pay attention to and think about. And you always have to keep that money like in cash, liquid and available, ready to be called. So if and when I do reinvest in more private real estate funds, I'll definitely be looking for funds that just get the money in initially and I don't have to think about it.
Yeah. Especially if you can start earning, you know, a preferred payment on it mm-hmm. right away, because for most real estate investments, it takes a few months for them to, you know, get that money deployed. And then it's kind of like, you know, either your money just sitting there or it's kind of just expenses the first few months. I mean, even here in Ukraine, it's very popular for people to buy, you know, new construction buildings that are not finished. And most of them take 2 to 4 years to even, you know, to even get built. So your money is basically just sitting like with the developers, and probably the same with your condos in Thailand. People don't factor that in. You know, people say like, oh, wow, you know, it was great that I, you know, doubled my money or it went up by this much or my cash flow is X. But people forget that for those 2 or 4 years that the money was just sitting there, that's money that wasn't deployed or working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Johnny and I guess both of us have been through interesting experiences over the last couple of years with buying physical real estate for our own, basically for our own purposes. I guess you've also invested in the Ukraine for cash flow. So you're like living one and renting one out. But you know, I wanted a kind of two updates. Like now that you're basically through the renovations more or less, and the dust has settled, do you think you'll be buying more real estate? And then as sort of a segue off that question, I want to hear what the experience is like in Kiev right now with the anticipation of a possible invasion by Mother Russia.
Yeah, so I actually had to make a video on my YouTube channel about this just yesterday or just recently, because I got so many messages and DMs and voicemails from friends, from family, just like panicking. The situation on the ground is completely different. Like people are just living normal lives. Nobody's really worried. You know, we all know that there's like a 5% chance that Ukraine will go to war, but they knew that for the last 4 years. You know, it's kind of like, you know, the best way I was able to explain to my mom is, you know, Taiwan has been at risk of war with China for the last 30 years. And yes, there's always a chance. So it's good to have a backup plan. But if you panic every single time China flexes or every time Russia flexes, you will never live your life. If I didn't have physical real estate here, if I didn't have my apartments, I wouldn't be here, to be honest. I would be in Thailand or, you know, maybe with you in Barcelona, just hanging out. But because I have a life here, I have a reason to stay. And I'm willing to take that 5% risk. And, you know, it could happen, but if I don't stay, there's 100% chance that I'll be missing out on this life and, you know, this life I'm building. So we could probably do a full episode on our real estate, you know, purchases and journeys in the future. But I remember saying, even when I bought this, I was like, it's probably not going to be an easy, you know, for sure, it's not going to be an easy hands-off investment. There's probably better ways for me to invest my money if I just wanted the gains, for example, a real estate fund, or some kind of, you know, or even an index fund or a REIT or something. But there's other side intangible benefits of actually being able to live in or touch or see your physical real estate.
And now, have you done any research on previous occupations where, like, what happened in Germany with property titles when Russia and the Allies occupied Germany after World War II? Like, were all property rights maintained?
I have no idea. I mean, honestly, I'm not gonna look into that. Like, I don't need to lose any sleep for that.
That's a curious point, though, right? Like, what happened in like Poland when Germany invaded and like basically what city did they like Krakow or Warsaw, like they basically just bombed it to like pieces, right?
Oh god,
like what happened if you own that? Did you still own the land if you owned a condo sitting on that land that was bombed?
I have no idea, but you know, let's not think about that.
But this is interesting, actually. I want to do an episode on this.
Like, yeah, you know what,
like you can do the research in a war-torn area or something. Okay, yeah. I like this, Derek.
Go for that.
Cue it up.
Oh god.
But to that degree, MLG Capital's focus of investing in properties in Middle America seems pretty safe and secure at this point.
Yeah, definitely. And it's definitely a lot more hands off, right? Yeah. So I do like funds for this reason. I'm glad they exist. I'm glad Tim came on to, you know, to speak about what happened in the last 2 years. And I'm looking forward to the rest of 2022 and seeing how the property market does. Cause so far the stock market has been terrible.
Yeah. The metaverse stock is just absolutely imploded, but we'll probably have some more follow-ups on that, but it is good to have these investments in real estate that are generating cash flow, because you can also live off that cash flow, but you also, in my particular case, I'm almost fully invested. So that cash that's coming in is the cash that I'm using to look at opportunities to invest in some of these beat up stocks, of recent. So I am enjoying the cash flow, and it was great to get an update from Tim just with regards to inflation and interest rates and how that particularly affects commercial real estate and multifamily. I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there. So much still to learn. I love to go back to school on some of these episodes.
Yeah, definitely. So thanks so much for Tim coming on the show. Sam, always good catching up.
Likewise. Hope everything turns out well in Kiev for many reasons, besides just your investments there. But yeah, we'll keep our fingers crossed and say a prayer for a positive and amicable turnout, because we definitely don't need anything more than that.
Yeah, definitely. So Sam, good catching up, and see you guys all next week.
Thanks for listening to the Best Like a Boss podcast. Join our mailing list at investlikeaboss.com to get exclusive access to our insider investment portfolios and our private members forum.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Tell your friends and leave us a review in the iTunes store. It helps more than you know. See you guys next week.